And we're live. Hello and a very warm welcome to Not the 92 Extra with me, Gregory Clark. As always, I'm your host and I'm joined as ever by Tom Mitchell. I hope you're all keeping well. We're joined tonight by a very special guest and one I'm left with absolutely no doubt you're all excited to listen to. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome him onto the show. Ladies and gentlemen, it's ex-Gretna, Dundee United, St Johnston, Hearts, Dunfermline, St Mirren, and Carlisle United player and captain, and also current Workington boss, Danny Granger. Danny, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you very much.
It's absolutely great to have you on the show. How's your weekend been? What have you been up to?
Very busy. Just off on the CFL, we were talking about it. It was my academy started back up now, so all the kids are back in, 120 kids a week, coaching them and things like that. So our matches started this weekend. We're in the National League, the Junior Premier League, play academies. We've been playing Carlisle United this weekend, so it's been great to have the kids back involved. I've had to shoot over to Workington to watch the reserves playing. They're playing in a local league as well, so it's a great chance for me to get over there and watch the youngsters there. So, yeah, it's been absolutely hectic. So it's back to normality with a bang, really. So it's been great.
Well, we'll certainly get into that as we continue in the conversation, and I'm very excited to hear about it, as I'm sure all listeners are. Well, without further ado, let's get straight into where it all began for you. So you're a Penrith boy. What was it like growing up there?
Fantastic. Obviously, you don't know anything different when you're sort of that age. And obviously, your eyes get opened up a little bit when you get older and you get into these big cities and things like that. But no, it was great. I think, obviously, we live just outside Penrith in a little small village. Grew up on a farm. Great family life. Very lucky to have been brought up the way I've been brought up. And in a village where there was sort of 13, 14 kids around the same age, football daft, all the lads. So it was brilliant and genuinely couldn't have wished for anything better, really.
You mentioned off air that you're a Manchester United fan. How did that come about?
Well, obviously, where we're located, I'm a Carlisle United fan to start with. And obviously, I went to watch a lot of their games when I was a kid, being on the doorstep. My dad was a Man United fan, so I kind of just followed in them footsteps. And they were winning a lot of trophies at the time, so it was great. We were celebrating every year, so it's a bit different now because my boy's a Man United and a Carlisle fan as well, but he doesn't get to see Man United lift many trophies. So, but no, it's obviously, it was great as a youngster supporting a club that was winning lots of trophies.
Well, you began your professional career with Gretna, just up the road. What was it like being involved with the club just at the start of their meteoric rise through the divisions?
Amazing. It was something that you could never really expect. I can remember the first conversation I had with Brooks Marlson. And I know a lot of people speak about Brooks in a sort of in a negative way about sort of coming into Scottish football and doing what he's doing and offering money and things like that, and I can understand what they're saying, but Brooks was fantastic. If it wasn't for Brooks Marlson, I probably would never have had a football career because Gretna wouldn't have been pushed to where they got pushed. So it was amazing. We had some great times as youngsters. We had obviously our YTS scholarship type thing as a bunch of youngsters. I'm really close with a lot of the lads that were on there. First team players that were amazing to learn off. Gavin Skeltons, Jamie McQuilkins, Davy Binghams, Derek Townsley, John O'Neill's, Alan Mains, you can go on forever. It was fantastic to see these types of players coming and playing at little old Gretna. So to be able to obviously start there, it was fantastic for me. Real eye-opener to what life was going to be like as a footballer. I think them early days really shaped it for me because you didn't get away with anything. And I think obviously that sort of settles in stone for what we had to be like going through as a footballer.
Well, Gretna down at Radio Park were, of course, famous, as you just mentioned, for attracting back then SPL level stars from, well, to Division 3. And they were on supposedly very lucrative deals thanks to Brooks Milson. I mean, you had Kenny Jukar, David Bingham, James Grady, to name a few. What was the general atmosphere like on a daily basis? You mentioned, of course, it gave you a real good grounding for what your career was going to be like in the future.
It was very old school. You had, don't get me wrong, the first team players looked after the youngsters when we cleaned the boots and things like that. Christmas time, you were always well looked after. But it was still quite old school. As a youngster, you had to knock to go into the first team dressing room. You had to sort of make sure that their boots and everything was right. And if they weren't right, they would tell you. And that, again, like I just said there, I think it was a massive, massive learning curve for us as youngsters. Not only to stay in football, but out with football that you can't sort of cut corners if you want to be successful. And like I say, the lads you mentioned there was a lot of them that were fantastic lads, and even now I still speak to quite a lot of them, James Grady's and the likes of David Bingham every now and then. The great people who helps you develop and become great lads. And to be honest with you, to be part of a dressing room like that, it was special.
I mean, of course, Gretna reached the Premier League eventually after beating Ross County 3-2 in the dying seconds up in Dingwall. How were the celebrations after that? Because it was renowned that Gretna didn't always have a great away following, but that day, it was like a 5-hour bus journey up to Dingwall. They travelled in their numbers in anticipating that you're going to gain promotion. What was it like to celebrate knowing you'd taken a club from Division 3 up to the SPL?
It was remarkable because, obviously, like you say, it was little old Gretna, 350 fans at a home game, and going all the way to Dingwall with nearly 1,000 people, the whole back end of the goal was full. And even now, even talking about it, I can still remember that feeling the second that James Grady hit the back of the net. It was just like, I think it was relief more than anything, because we probably should have done it weeks in advance. We'd sort of got away from St Johnstone, but St Johnstone had came back and ended up sort of nearly pipping us. So, and again, in Gretna, in the way Gretna always done it, it was kind of last minute, dying seconds. Our kickoff had been delayed 10 minutes. The helicopter was on the way to Hamilton where St Johnstone were playing, and that was one of the best days. Obviously, I've been very, very lucky and I've had some great days in my football career, but that is definitely up there with one of the best feelings, to score a 90th minute winner. Not me personally, obviously, but as your team scores that 90th minute winner to get you promoted into the biggest league in the country, it was fantastic.
It certainly sounded like it would have been. And of course, like the logistics change slightly when you get to, well, not slightly, they change completely when you go up to the SPL. Radio Parks, though, doesn't meet the criteria to play in the SPL, therefore all your home games are then moved to Fir Park. What was it like for the players having to play there as opposed to the Fortress Radio, as it was known back then?
Strange, very strange. Probably hampered us. Your likes of Hamilton's and St Johnstone's, whoever was in the league at that point, was coming to Glasgow. They weren't coming all the way down to Gretna. So it was always very, very, very tough for us. We were travelling as far for a home game as we were for an away game. Not as many fans coming up the road. I think there was one game we played in Vanessa, there was 250 fans there. I've said it before, and I openly think it's correct in the fact that if we hadn't have been promoted that year, I still think Gretna would have been able to plug along in the Scottish Football League. I think they'll have bounced between Championship first and second, or up and down, similar to your Clydes and your Airdries, teams like that. I think the day we got promoted to the SPL, as much as it was a blessing for myself as on a personal note being able to play in that league, I think it was the beginning of the end, because you look at the teams you're going up against, your Rangers, your Celtics, Aberdeen, Hibs, Hearts, little old Gretna could never ever compete with them. And I think, obviously, again, it was a dream come true for us all to be able to step out on the pitch as an SPL player. But I think, obviously, it was very, very different being up at Motherwell rather than at Gretna.
One thing we have slightly missed out on was another critical juncture in Gretna's history, reaching the 2006 Scottish Cup final against one of your future clubs, Hearts. Were you involved in that? And what are your main memories of that game?
I've got very bad memories of that cup final, actually. I was on loan at Brechin in the second half of the season. I'd been Rowan Alexander had pulled me and said, listen, I want you to play a vital part in our championship. Well, Division 1 at that time, but it was championship now. Before we go to the SPL, I want you to play as many games as we can, but I want you to go into that division now and play. Brechin were bottom of the league, so I went up to there. I wasn't playing much at Gretna. So I went up a division higher than Gretna on loan for the last half of the season. Gretna got to the Scottish Cup semi-final. I think they beat Dundee, if I'm correct. Then I wasn't available for that because I was out on loan. Came back to the final. Season had finished. I came back and trained with the team all week, done all the preparation, got to Friday, getting on the bus, team suit all ready, and the secretary pulls me off the bus and says, I'm not allowed to be involved tomorrow. They just had an email through after confirming the squad list saying that because I was ineligible for the semi-final, I wasn't allowed to be involved in the final. So it was like I say, that was just obviously when you've been with Gretna from day one, and this is at that point was the biggest day in their history, and it meant a lot to me. And yeah, it was really, really tough. So obviously, as of that, the whole day was kind of a blur. And then obviously, one of my best friends, Gav, missing the vital penalty was hard to watch as well for me.
So what did you do with yourself that day? Did you just stay at home?
Or? Stayed at home, yeah, and then travelled up on the day up to Hampden.
That must have been a second or two watch, especially when...
Yeah, the manager offered me to go to the hotel and things like that, but I just didn't want to be there. I couldn't be there. And it was, again, I was only a kid, and I did have a lot of bad luck in finals regarding being involved in them, up until obviously the big one for myself. It was, I didn't get much luck. I think I missed three or four in my career before I finally got to one. So, it was disappointing, obviously very hard for me to accept. But one of them things, you just got to sort of dust yourselves off and go again. And rightly, we did the next season, we won the league.
You touched on this man earlier, Brooks Mileson, the man behind the Gretna journey. How do you sum him up?
It's so hard because I've got so much respect, so much time, and I genuinely do hate when I hear people speaking badly of him. And he had a dream and he made his dream come true. If we all could make our dream come true, we would do it, and he done it. Brooks was one of the nicest guys going. He would wait back, make sure every player was looked after, made sure every youngster got a lift home, made sure they got the bus, and if they missed the bus, it was just incredible what he would do. And he was never, for a man that had the money that he had, he was never flash with it. It was always, anything he'd done it from his heart. And I think that was probably his downfall at times. He'd done too much for people and trusted too many people, and ended up probably doing things he didn't have to do. But again, I've always said, if it wasn't for Brooks Mileson and things like that, Rowan Alexander and Derek Fry, I would never have been a professional footballer.
The club fell into severe financial difficulty, culminating in several first-team players leaving the club. What was it like being around the club at that time?
I was quite lucky in the fact that I did get out before all the financial side came about. I think we played Kilmarnock away, and I'd had a really good game, and I think I'd scored one and set up two, and we won 3-0. And then I got a phone call on that night off my agent saying, listen, just keep your phone close to you tonight. And he never said that. So I knew something was sort of going on. I'm like, listen, what's going on type of thing. And this was 22nd or 23rd of December. So it's obviously getting close to the transfer window. And I was like, what's going on? He said, oh, there's a little bit of interest, but there's nothing sort of to worry about type thing. Just keep your phone close to you. So that was that. About 2 hours later, I get a phone call. Right, you need to go to Brooks Mileson and ask him how much he wants for you. And I was like, right, why? He's like, well, there's a team wants to buy you, but they want to know what the transfer fee is first. So, cut a long story short, I phoned Brooks. Brooks had asked who the club was. I'd gone back, found out it was Dundee United, and he asked me if I wanted to leave, and I just said yes. I said, I can't turn down Dundee United. Craig Levein, Peter Houston, massive club. And he just said to me, right, that's fine, no problem. He said, you get me a development fee, I think, which one it was called at the time, for a transfer fee, and that's you can go. I'm not going to stand in your way. If you want to go and play for another club with a bigger agenda than us, then I'm not going to stand in your way. And that was Brooks. He was kind, and that was what he was like. He always said to me that if I needed anything, I was to phone him, and he genuinely meant it. And again, like I say, another manager would have sat there and said, no, you're playing every week for us. We want five times the amount of what we've got now. But he just said, listen, it was a token gesture. That's what it was. And again, after that, a lot of my friends, obviously the likes of Gavin Skelton and people like that, were going through a hell of a time. And it was horrible to watch from me, but I just felt it was the right time to get out. And lucky enough, it was great timing by myself.
We moved on to Dundee United, as you just said. What were your first impressions of Craig Levein?
Scary man. Scary, scary man. No, him and Houston were perfect for each other. Houston was the laughy, jokey, speak to everybody every day. And Craig would stand on the sidelines, arms crossed, chest up, chin up, and you didn't dare do anything wrong. And it was just, that was Craig though. He just had that aura about him, and he's a fantastic, fantastic manager. I remember one of my first pre-season, I signed in the January, but then pre-season, we were at St Andrews, and I remember we were doing this massive run, 1,000-metre run, and he blew his whistle, so we all went running in and went, oh, he must be mega pleased with this. We're like, eight of the 10 runs done, must be mega pleased with this, he's going to cut it short. Get in there, and he's like, not good enough, lads, we're starting again, we're doing another 10. And we had to do another 10, and it was just like, and it was, he'd done a lot of things for sort of a mental challenge more than anything. And but yeah, his training, his and Hughes' training was fantastic. Amazing, amazing duo together.
I think they were known as good cop, bad cop, aren't they?
Yeah, very, very good cop, bad cop.
In that dressing room, there were a few big talents, none other than David Goodwillie, who was emerging at that time. Who were the other big talents in the dressing room that you were immediately impressed by?
It was a big, big dressing room. You had the likes of Lee Wilkie, Darren Dodds, massively experienced players. You had Sean Dillon, John Daly, Noel Hunt, Craig Conway, Willow Flood, Magaro Gomez, Prince Warburton, Gary Kenneth. It was, when I turned up and we started training, I was like, whoa, this is like the real deal, this. Like, you then had Johnny Russell coming through, players like that. It was a very, very close dressing room. We all moved into a little sort of, a lot of the lads lived in a little village just outside. I moved up, John Daly and his wife Linda sort of took me underneath as sort of the little baby of the thing. First time I've been away from home, and they sort of mothered me. We were so close. It was, like I said, there was five or six of us in this little village. We'd go to the little local pub on a Sunday for dinner together. And I think that's why we were all so close. Even now, still like Craig Conway, Willows and things like that, I still speak to them. And I think it's very rare in football you get dressing rooms like that. You leave a dressing room and you'll say, yeah, we've been good mates for like 2 years. But you don't really keep in touch. I mean, I've been away from Dundee United since 2010. And I still speak to quite a lot of the dressing room.
That was your first time away from home, of course. And that can be daunting for anyone, no matter how old you are, if it is the first time you've ever left. How did you find living near Dundee? And did you ever go into Dundee to socialise?
Yeah, it was very, very strange for me. Going from a little sort of town, Carlisle being a massive city to me, but going up to Dundee and I can remember one of my first meetings with Houston and Craig. He just said, make sure you sample the nightlife. And I thought, is this a test? I'm thinking, am I not meant to go out or something like this? And there was an Irish bar in Dundee, in Malone's, it was called. We used to always go there after the game for a few drinks. And I'll never forget my first time I went in. So I walked in and next thing you know, loads of people are coming up, like asking for pictures. And I'm thinking, nah, the lads are sticking me in here. Like it's, I thought they were widening me up, like type thing. I'm thinking, never had this before in my life. But that was the thing of Dundee. It was the two, you were loved or you were hated. It was football daft, and that's what it was like. And I can remember going back to the training ground on the Monday, and Craig pulled me in and went, oh, we had a good weekend. I was like, yeah, quite quiet, but it was all right. Did you go out? And I was thinking, oh no, what do I say? Yeah. And then I went, yeah. He went, yeah, I know you have. I was just checking you weren't going to lie to me. So I had a bit of a panic up, but no, it was brilliant. Obviously, Dundee was fantastic. Big eye-opener for me. But a great bunch of lads that you could go out with. And my wife moved up, my girlfriend at the time, but my wife moved up about 6 months later. And again, very close with everyone as well.
You made 23 appearances for the club. Why did you only stay one season? And how did you end up leaving?
I'd obviously joined in the January. And I played quite a lot in the first 6 months. And then they had the CIS Cup final, what it was at the time. Again, another final that I missed. But I'd been booked, I think it was the last game of the season, so I missed the first two games of the following season. We signed Paul Dixon in the summer, and he came in, first two games, done really well, and that was it. Couldn't get him out. And credit to Craig Levein, he stuck with him. And he must have been sick of me knocking his door every other Friday, asking why I wasn't getting the opportunity. But when you look back now, Dicker had probably the best season of his life and ended up getting a move. I think it was 18 months later. And I just wanted to play football. I was an 18, 19-year-old kid that just wanted to play football. That's all I wanted to do. And at the time, St Johnstone had just been promoted to the SPL. And we were living halfway between Perth and Dundee. And Craig just came into me one day and he said, listen, he said, St Johnstone have approached for you. You don't have to leave, but there's an opportunity there if you do want to go. So I kind of thought, well, I don't know. I know Tony Docherty, but I don't really know any other lads there. I thought I would have a chat with them. Went down and chatting straight away. I just thought, yeah, this is for me. Derek McInnes was fantastic. I've openly said probably the best manager I've ever worked under, Derek. And like I say, as soon as I spoke to him, I was going there, and it was ideal for me. I didn't have to move house, didn't have to uproot again. So it ticked a lot of boxes for me. And again, didn't leave on Dundee bad terms at all. It was a fantastic club. I'm happy that they've done as well as what they've done, and I'm glad they're back in the SPL because they are a massive club, and that's where they deserve to be.
A lot of players that we've spoke to have played under Derek McInnes and Tony Dock. What makes them so impressive when you first meet them, and what makes you want to sign for them so much?
You feel some managers you can go to and you can feel that they're the manager and the miles above you, and they're trying to demand the respect. Somehow they get it. They get the respect straight away, whether it's the way they sit and talk to you. First meeting, do you want a coffee, do you want a tea? And you feel comfortable straight away. And for me, that was massive. And as soon as I walked in, first day at training, didn't know really where I was going. We trained at a little school outside Perth. And Doc was like, yeah, jump in my car, I'll take you along. And just little things like, rather than saying, look, follow me, it was, you're jumping my car, you need to drive, you just jump. And little things like that just made you feel, didn't make you feel any less than them, but you knew that they were there and they were very, I said, Derek and Tony were, in my eyes, years ahead of what the game was at that point. The management skills were frightening. Like, Houston and Craig were fantastic as a duo. Doc and Dell, fantastic as a duo. And I think the two of them worked together so well, and I think it was vital that they did so.
Well, you spent two seasons there. You racked up 6 to 9 appearances. What was the highlight of your time in Perth?
I would probably say the 4-1 win over Rangers. One night at St Johnstone at McDermott, we absolutely destroyed them. And it was just one of them nights where everything went for us. I mean, Killian Sheridan had an absolute field day, scored an absolute worldie. It was just, again, it was. I've been very, very lucky. I've not been involved in many poor dressing rooms. It was a great dressing room. Liam Craig, Murray Davidson, Stephen Anderson, Dave Mackay. Great, great lads. You know what I mean? Good crack. He enjoyed going to work. He enjoyed going to training. It was never a chore. You'd stay back. We had a head tennis court underneath one of the stands. Couldn't get Paul Sheeran off it. It was unbelievable. Absolute frightening touch. He was scary good. Like, people like that you could learn off, Jody Morris, Chris Millers, people like that. Just, like I say, just great crack to go into training every day.
You said it was obviously great crack. How was it in terms of socialising comparing Perth to Dundee? Or would you always go back to Dundee to hang out with your pals?
Because I was very close with the Dundee United boys, and my wife was very close with them, we always sort of went out with them as couples and things like that. So I did kind of, because there was a lot of our car school, St Johnstone had a car school from Glasgow, so they tended to go out in Glasgow a lot. So I tended to then go back and socialise with the United boys, which I used to get absolutely hammered for. Even when we played them, they'd be like, oh, don't tackle him, he's your friend, remember, and things like that. But no, it was great. We did have team nights out. We did have days away, the races and things like that. But again, it was just mainly more so where we stayed up. I stayed up in Dundee with a lot of the Dundee United boys.
I mean, it seemed It seems like it's a very, very successful time for you. You're really enjoying being at the club. The dressing room was a very good place to be. Why did you decide to leave?
Two reasons, really. I was offered a new contract 2 months before the end of the season, and my wife was pregnant at the time with my son, Oliver, and we kind of didn't know what to expect, first child, things like that. So we did say we wanted to move home, where Carlisle were showing a little bit of interest. I always said I wanted to play for Carlisle at some point in my career. So it seemed to tick a lot of boxes. And also, Derek McInnes was never going to be there much longer. He was flying, linked with every job going. And that was one of the reasons I left. No disrespect to St Johnstone. I love the club. Absolutely fantastic club. Ran by great people. Ran properly. Loyal fans. But I knew Derek McInnes was going to leave. It was a matter of time. And I said that to him. I said that was one of the reasons why I want to leave. I don't think you're going to be here in 6 months' time. And I signed for you and Doc because of how you made me feel. And from then, he just said, you can't act like that. You can't think like that. And I think that's what was hard for them, because even though I knew they were going to leave, there was nothing sort of concrete that they were going to. But in hindsight, obviously, I knew it was going to happen, and it did happen in the near future.
Well, from St Johnstone to Edinburgh for Hearts. Hearts is the club you're arguably most associated with in Scotland, given how successful you were there. How did that move to Tynecastle come about?
Very, very strange. Obviously, I openly said that I wanted to move closer to home. I think, obviously, I don't know who it was. It was one of the papers I put on that I'd asked Carlisle to come and get me because I want to go home and all this sort of thing. So it kind of ended sour with St Johnstone. And it does hurt me when because I do get a lot of stick from their fans, because I love my time at St Johnstone. I absolutely loved it. But I can remember having conversations with Carlisle, and then all of a sudden my agent phoned me just saying, oh, Hearts have shown a little bit of interest. What do you think? And I just said, get it done. Like, doesn't matter what. Don't argue over contracts. Don't argue over money. Just get it done. So whatever they offer, just take it. Yeah, but I can get a little bit. No, I said, just get it done. I said, I want to go there. You asked 90% of footballers in Scotland where they would want to play a game. It would be Hearts. So Hearts is a place that every footballer loves, absolutely loves. The atmosphere, whether you're home or away, that's where you love the atmosphere. Look, Celtic and Rangers are unbelievable places to play. But unless they're absolutely bouncing, the Hearts is where everyone wants to play. I know some won't say that, but I know for a fact that's where everyone enjoys playing the most. And obviously, manager like Jim Jeffries, he's had a massive, massive influence on my career that he doesn't realise. He ticked so many boxes for me. And again, one of the biggest clubs in Scotland.
We'll get on to the Jet and Billy Brown in a little second. But first of all, I think Hearts fans would be interested to know, of that crop in 2011, 2012 kind of era, who impressed you the most in the dressing room when you arrived?
Webster, Andy Webster. Absolutely different class. Absolute light years ahead of everything. Just so... Never shouted, but words would literally tear through you. It was just one of them. And Rudy, obviously Rudy's Rudy. He was, he'd walk in some mornings. Morning, Rudy. Get a grump out of him. Other mornings, he'd be the soul of the dressing room. But he got on the training ground and that was it. It was work mode, and Rudy wanted to win no matter what, as long as he wasn't at a running exercise. Yeah, look, fantastic. Just a different level again. And every step through my career, you just got your eyes open that little bit more. Like I say, it was the club, the stature, the players. You walk into a dressing room, you've got six or seven international lads. You're like, this is different level now.
You mentioned Rudy Scatchell, of course. How obvious was it that he had played at the level he had? He played for Marseille. He played in the Championship for Southampton, who were chasing promotion back to the EPL. How obvious was it? And was he just ridiculous?
It was ridiculous if he got the ball at his feet, yeah. He didn't move around a lot. But again, someone who... He was just a winner. that was the biggest thing for me. Like, I walked into that dressing room, and when you're on the training pitch, it was, whether it was a head tennis, whether it was two touch, whether it was a five-a-side, whether it was an 11-a-side, it was, you had to win at all costs. And that was from the youngsters right the way through to the oldest man, Big Zal, drivers, Gowsers, Ryan Stevensons, Jamie Hamels, Meddy Tyules, Stevie Elliott, Suttons. You could go at temps. There's just so many of them. They just, you had to win. That was it. No matter what, you had to win. So again, it was just fantastic to be involved in.
Okay, so you worked with Jim Jeffries and Billy Brown. What were they like to play under? And how much of a factor was the prospect of working with them influential in your decision to sign for the club?
Obviously, I played against Jim and Billy quite a lot, so you kind of know what they're about. You know how their teams play. You know what they expect. I'm quite an old-school type person that you kind of want it told the way it is. And they've done that. There was never any sort of papering over cracks, but it was always done professionally. It was never a personal dig. It was always professional. And like I say, once at sports, I went over to Tynecastle to speak to them before I'd actually signed. Well, they were signing. Walked into their office, and it was just, they were brilliant. It was just like the way they bounced off each other. But again, their demeanour came out in the players. They were winners. They didn't care about anything apart from winning. And whether it was Route 1, whether it was total football, all they wanted to do was win. And they were very, very good at what they'd done.
It's safe to say that Jim Jeffries has a reputation in Scotland for being quite irascible, bit of a temper on him. How much was that manifested, and how often did you see that?
I think I only seen it once or twice. But yeah, bit like Craig, but Craig was obviously very, very, didn't say a lot, whereas Jim was sort of involved with the banter a lot more, and you kind of got a little bit closer. I thought you'd let your guard down a little bit with Jim, and then if you went, it was like, oof. So, yeah, but I think obviously for me, I mean, as I said there about Derek, Jim's had the biggest influence on my career. He's took me to the club that I've absolutely loved the most, my time at by a long way, obviously, apart from the coming home. And then later in my career, he saved me from not finishing. And he's a fantastic person. And even now, I speak to him quite a lot. I speak to him on the phone, ask him for advice. I meet him for a coffee every now and then because he's someone that I believe he's a big part of a development, and he's quite happy to help, and that's what you want.
Paulo Sergio joins as manager in August 2011. What were your first impressions of him, and to what extent did they change over time?
No one probably wanted Paulo to get the job. No one wanted anybody to get the job because every player in that dressing room loved Jim, and Jim had brought us all in and worked with us for so long and been close with us all. And I think we felt like he'd been unfairly treated, and you previously spoke about the big run that they'd gone on prior to them finishing the season, unbeaten, being talked about challenging. And then all of a sudden, I think when we were in Europe, I think we'd drawn or we'd only won one in our first four or five games. And then all of a sudden, we came into the office like, where's Gaffer? And he's not in today. He's been relieved of his duties. And this is Paulo. And we were like, so it wasn't even a case of having time to sort of digest it. It was just like flick a switch, and it was like, you've changed managers. Like, no, not even any inkling. I don't think anybody had an inkling of it. And you walk into training and there he is, and it's like, oh my dears. And Paulo was just very, very different. Jim was usual possessions, small sizes, shape, enjoy it, race it, all that side. Paulo was very tactical. Right, we're doing 11v11 on a pause, and this is, you've got to run here, you've. So again, it was very different for us. And over time, Paulo became, it was set his way in the start, but over time, there was a few of the senior lads had gone and said, listen, the boys need a little bit more of this, we're used to this. And he could have quite easily gone, no. But he didn't. He said, right, yeah, it's fine, no problem. We'll do my stuff, but then we'll do a bit of your stuff. And again, over time, Paulo just got the boys, worked the boys round and round and round. And again, a fantastic, fantastic manager. Fantastic person. I was out in Portugal last year and I met him for a beer, and he's just, he was a fantastic person. And it was funny because it was very different to what anybody's ever been used to.
Well, that season is, of course, remembered predominantly for what happened on Saturday, May the 19th, the Scottish Cup final against Hibs. Before we talk about that, you played Celtic in the semi. How confident were you were going to win that?
When you're playing Celtic, you're never confident. You're hopeful. You hope to catch them on a bad day. At the end of the day, people can always say what they want about Celtic and Rangers. You have to catch Celtic and Rangers on a bad day to get anything out of them. What they have at their disposal, the armour they have, the players that they can go and attract, is why they're a massive club. Now, you catch them on a bad day, which we have done before, it's like anything. You've just got to hope that it's one of them days for you. And that day, Paolo had a masterclass, to be fair to him. He set us up tactically to draw them onto us, and then they would change. He expected them to change formations. They'd done that. He changed our formation at that point, brought Craig Beattie on, and all of a sudden, you're winning the game, and then we get the slice of luck that we get the penalty in the last minute of the game.
Did you expect Craig Beattie to do that celebration around the pitch?
No, not really. No one wants to see Beach with his top off, let's be honest. It's not a pretty sight. Beach was actually my roommate when we were away in the hotel, so it was quite strange because Jamie Hamill had been our penalty taker right the way through and always was, never missed a penalty. And unfortunately, Jamie had done his ACL in the, I don't know if it was the week leading up to that or previously, but all of a sudden, no one knew who was taking the penalty. And Beach just grabbed the ball and stuck it down. And if you actually watch the video back, as Beach scores and goes running off, there's me, Darren Barr, and I think it's Andrew Driver, just put the brakes on because we're all in yellow cards. And if we get booked, we're thinking, oh, you're going to miss another final. So the way me and Daz are standing there on the edge of the thing, it's just like, oh, just mental. But no, it was fantastic. And I think obviously previous to that, obviously the morning of the Saturday when I think Hibs were playing Aberdeen, I was absolutely buzzing. I was like, Hibs are winning. Yeah, if we win, we'll get Hibs in the final. Blackies, Gary Locks, Gowsers, Drive. Oh, we don't want Hibs. We don't want Hibs. I'm like, are you crazy? I tell you, you want in the final? And they're like, no, if we ever lost that, even though we're better than them, you'll never know what it'll do. And until actually after the cup final, I now realise why they didn't want it. Because as much as we're now well known in Gorgie, I don't think we'd be well known in Gorgie if we'd have lost that game. I don't think I'd have been allowed back up there. So, yeah, no, I can see why they didn't want it in the end.
So I wanted Danny just to talk about the final itself as its own segment, because I feel a lot of the supporters will like to hear about the stories of that day and how it all went. So, what was the preparation like going into the game?
Just there was absolutely no difference from a league game. Obviously, there was a lot of hype, more press. Paolo kept it as normal as possible. We didn't travel. We didn't do final suits. He just wanted it to be as normal as possible. So we stayed up in Edinburgh, trained in Edinburgh until Friday or Saturday, whichever day. I was lost for days then now. But yeah, it was just normal. The only time it was any different was when we got down to Glasgow. We had a couple of more meetings than what we did normally. A couple more video things, went over a few more bits and bobs, but apart from that, it was just a normal week, and it probably settled us down because bar probably Webby, Zal, Rudy and Stephen Elliott, we were quite a young squad, so it was something that could have sort of overawed us if we let it.
Gary Locke is on record saying he became aware of the Hibs team days before the final. Was this relayed to the players?
It was sort of dripped in, as in this is what we've heard that could potentially be the team, but it wasn't something that took as concrete because I think obviously they've sort of said that they could have been playing sort of double bluff. But as always, we said leading up to that week, I think we played Hibs four times that season and beat them three times and drawn one. We said that if we turned up, it was our game, we would win it. And we knew that, and Paolo was very much like that. Even when we played Celtic and Rangers, it was always about a lot about us. Gave us a little bit of information about others, but always about us. And he made that clear leading up to that game. And I think, obviously, it paid dividends because he put a lot of belief in us as players as well.
Of course, the Hibs team that day had the likes of Ivan Sproul, Gary O'Connor, Lee Griffiths. Who did Paolo identify as being the Hibs danger men?
Obviously, we knew the likes of Lee Griffiths is a fantastic player. I know he gets a lot of stick off our fans and things like that, but he's a talent, and you give him a chance, he'll score, and he's done that many times. And I think obviously that was a big thing for us, is keeping Lee Griffiths quiet. And if we kept Lee Griffiths quiet, we knew we'd have a right good chance. We looked at their team and it was full of a lot of individuals. Take out the likes of probably James McPay, Paul Hanlon and Louis Stevenson. The rest of them, there didn't seem a great deal of team spirit in there. We felt like there was people there just sort of just waiting for the time to pass, and then they'd be away from the club. And that's how it felt. And we knew that if we'd sort of done what we did, we would have a good day. And Zal and Webby that day were absolutely phenomenal. We kept Gary O'Connor and Lee Griffiths quiet. Blackie ran the show from midfield. He had a field day. Me and Gowers got up and down and driving tormented their fullbacks, as did Suso and Rudy and Stevie Elliott were different class as well. So and then Daz Bar done what Daz Bar done best and just sort of done the ugly side type of it. So no, it was a great day, obviously, but we were confident from as soon as we got through that we would do the business.
So talk us through the emotions during the game. You step onto the field 20 minutes in, Scatchell gets the opener. Now, sorry, Darren Barr gets the opener. How are you feeling when that goal goes in? Do you start to settle down then?
I'll be honest with you, I was quite calm. I woke up in the morning and I'd been for a walk and I came back into the... I've been down for my breakfast and I came back in the room. Beach was still asleep. I came back into the room and Beach is sat there with his bathrobe on, feet up on a thing with a cup of tea. And I'm just like, this is mental. Like, it's Scottish Cup final day. How are you so calm? And that calmed me down. And then as you approach Hampden, you sort of go underneath the stand to go into the change rooms. And as literally as we dropped down, seen all my family and friends, and I mean, I had 50, 60 people there coming to watch the game, and I seen them all there standing right on the barrier, and just then that was it. My butterflies started and everything, and then I remember going out for the warm up, and Gowser are looking across at me, and just he has this big stupid grin on his face, and it's like, yeah, just calm me down again. And then as you say, the game goes on, and you get that goal, and then all of a sudden you think, yeah. Because we started off really well. We started off dominant. And I think, obviously, we got a lot of territory. And then all of a sudden, when you get that goal, you think, right, this is where we can sort of pick them off, because Rudy finds pockets and Black is running the show. You've got a right good chance here. And obviously, it carried on like that.
What extent were you surprised by Hibs and their approach to the game? Because they didn't get their chance to stamp their authority on the game at all.
I was shocked, because I just felt like the Scottish Cup final, and just felt like it was just, as I say, they just felt like it was there, they were there to pass the time. And I felt sorry for some of the lads, because there was some of the lads there that just weren't bothered. And as much as you are, I do hate, each side of it hates each other. You do want, there is some good lads there, and you wouldn't want them to be looked at in the way that probably would have been after that cup final, because some people weren't bothered. And it was hard. It was probably hard for them. But overall, like you say, we felt that we were dominant of them. We had more than them. And on another day, we could have gone for more and we could have got more quite easily in that last 20 minutes. But it was just a case of seeing out time.
Well, not only do you end up on the winning side, but you actually score. How nervous were you when you're stepping up to take what arguably was a decisive moment in the game, that penalty?
Well, obviously, I'd spoke to my dad the night before. I speak to my dad quite a lot about football things, and I'd spoke to my dad the night before, and he just said to me, he said, right, where are you going if we get a penalty shootout? And I went, it's not going to go to a penalty shootout. He said, I know it's not, but just tell me where you're going. So I said, I'm going to go to the keeper's right, not a lot of pace, just going to lift it high. And he said, right, he says, no matter what, he says, if it goes to a penalty shootout, do not change your mind and go there. He says, if you miss, you'll be fine. He says, if you change your mind and miss, you'll always say, I would have scored if I'd have stuck to my guns, and you'll never leave it down. So he just said, stick to your guns and go there. And then we're sitting having breakfast or pre-match, can't remember which one it was. Meeting finishes. Paolo's walking out, and as he walks past me, taps me on the head, says, Danny, you're on penalties today. And that was it. And then obviously the penalty comes. I was surprisingly confident, because I knew where I was going. And I was like, obviously there was quite a delay by the time the boy had walked off after getting sent off. And I can remember placing the ball. And even now I turn, I see the video and I see Blackie looking the other way. I thought, you cheeky little... Yeah, absolutely no faith in me at all, does he? Do you know what I mean? But no, I was confident. I was always confident striking a dead ball. Obviously, I took all the corners for the club, free kicks. And obviously, the penalty on that famous day.
Hearts destroy Hibs 5-1 and won the 2012 Scottish Cup. What were the celebrations like after? A little birdie has told me that you ended up in a social club in Bonnyrigg.
You've got too many sauces, do you, haven't you? Yeah, so obviously, the celebrations, we're getting back on the bus. One of the lounges where near the bus, this woman's walking past with all this crate of beers and that. Andrew Driver and Gowser jump off, just put all them beers on here. So we get all them beers on there and drive back to Edinburgh, coming down Gorgie Road, and there's just fans everywhere. And you're like, oh. So me and Driver... By the way, you can see there's a common denominator here, Driver. It's always Driver. Pop the emergency exit off the top of the roof. So me, Gowser, Driver sat on the top of the bus as we're coming down Gorgie Road and all the fans. And just insane. And then the party, all the family had come back on another bus and met us at Tiny Gorgie Suite. Had a party under there. Driver's on the drumsticks and Stevie Elliott's on the karaoke. Just brilliant. And then the Sunday, obviously, we have the open-top bus. An incredible experience. And then afterwards, me and Gal, a lot of the lads went back with the families. And we said, right, we'll meet in town tonight at 8 o'clock. And me and Gal was like, I'm not stopped yet. Like, we're just partying. Like, and Lockie says, come back to this social club with us. It's only quiet. There'll only be 50 or 60 people. Like, it'll be good crack, though. So me and Gal was just like, yeah, whatever, wherever there's a party, we're coming. So... go out to Bonnyrigg, get to this social club, doors open, there's about 500 people in this. By the way, they'd have been shut down if they'd have seen all these people in there. But it was like, Gowser walks onto the stage, me, I walk onto the stage, the whole place erupts. Next thing you know, Gowser goes, watch this, I'm going to the bar, runs and jumps off and crowd surfs across the people to the bar. So I'm like, I'll have a go at that as well. So I'm getting crowd surfed across to the bar. But it meant something to them people, that win. And like I said previously, like, I wondered why Gowser and Lockie and Drivers and Jamie McDonald didn't want this game, because I seen what it meant to them when we won it. It would have absolutely destroyed them if you didn't win it. And I've always said it is quite cheesy when I say it, but spending that afternoon with them fans was amazing. It was great to spend it with them, because it wasn't the fact that it was an ego boost for me and Gals, or it meant something to them, and it meant something to us because we felt a connection to the club. And the amount of people you speak to who have been at Hearts and still go back year after year, it's because it's a special club and that's what it's like.
How awful was your hangover the next day? Then you had to go on an open top bus around Princess Street, around Edinburgh. What is that experience like as well? It must be the closest thing I can imagine to feeling like a god.
Surreal, so surreal. People on top of buses, people up lampposts, hanging out with shop windows. Just surreal. Absolutely surreal. That's the only word you could, like. One point I remember turning around, looking back behind the bus when we're coming up to, towards Haymarket, and there's just miles of people. This is insane. Like, just crazy. But people talk about the match in the 5-1, but they're the memories that really, really stick to you, that feeling of seeing everyone and just a surreal feeling of the enjoyment with the fans, having a beer and a few more liquids. It was just brilliant. The whole, from the minute we left the hotel, driving up towards the stadium, seeing all as soon as you came around the corner to Hampden, seeing all the colours, seeing all the fans, dropping down, seeing all my family, the whole game, the penalty, the cup, the party in the dressing room, how close we all were. We'd had a horrendous year not getting paid. We had all the staff, the backroom staff, the office staff were in with us. It was just brilliant. Really was. And it was such a close-knit group. And we actually said, 2 or 3 days later, we said, if we keep Paolo and we add 2 or 3 more players to this group, this group could challenge. Never going to, in my eyes, there won't many be in for a long time before someone actually does pip Celtic or Rangers to the SPL. But there's teams that can split them. And I genuinely thought that the following year could have been our year.
My next question actually was centering on that. Of course, that summer the Rangers were liquidated, therefore they were no longer in existence. Hearts had a real chance to step up to be not only the second force, but did you feel as a group there was a chance you could become a force to the extent you could topple Celtic as well?
Again, I don't think you can ever sort of sit there and say, yeah, we should be toppling Celtic, because I think when you look at what they have and the resources and who they can attract and what they can attract, there shouldn't be a chance of ever doing it. But you sat there and you thought, you know what, we could have a right chance here of having a go here and maybe being that team that finishes second. Or, I think obviously that summer was vital for the club, and you could just sense it was the start of the horrible few months that was about to happen. Paolo leaving, I think Rudy left that summer, a couple of others left, and you just think, yeah, this is starting to turn a little bit here.
Well, the strength of that Scottish Cup winning squad was exemplified when you played Liverpool over two games the following season in Europa League. What was your feeling when Reina spills Templeton's shot and you equalise under the Anfield lights?
European nights, the amount of people have always said, European nights are different. You think, well, how can they be any different? They're under the same floodlights, they're on the same pitch. It's like, but they were, the atmosphere was mad. Like, even the ones that we played the season before, Tottenham and Pax, it was like just different. And then you look at Liverpool, and it was Liverpool, and you're walking out standing next to Carragher, and you're standing next to Sterling, and you're just thinking, this is Suarez. This is mental. This is absolutely the European night against Liverpool, one of the biggest clubs in European football history. We're playing them on a European night, and then Pepe Reina decides he wants to chuck one in for us. Mad. And you're just thinking, right, get them to penalties. Then Suarez goes and does that, and you think, ah, well, that was short-lived. But no, it was, unbelievable. Anfield's just one of them ones, very much like Tynecastle. The atmosphere was different level.
That season, the debris of Romanov's tenure starts to show and the club fall into financial difficulty. What was a general experience like having been relatively close to a similar thing at Gretna?
Horrible, because at Gretna, you kind of knew that they didn't have that fan base. It would affect a lot of people, but it wouldn't affect, there was hundreds of staff, thousands of fans. It was just heartbreaking to see. Obviously, I then done my knee in November. I then didn't play again that season. Gary Locke said that he wanted to keep me, but couldn't keep me. Just awful, absolutely awful. And so hard to be involved with, and felt useless at times, that you couldn't be on the pitch and you couldn't be on the behind the boys when you're going through all this thing because you're injured. I think obviously we played St Mirren my last home game. I scored, and it was the one that they were saying that this could be the last game of Hearts ever game. You're thinking, how can a club like this be going down this route?
You went on to play for St Mirren and Dunfermline later on after leaving Hearts. Overall, across all your clubs in Scotland, from Gretna through to Dunfermline, who would you say your toughest opponent was?
Nakamura. Played against him a couple of times. I was Dundee United, and I think once when I was at St Johnstone. But yeah, just so not much pace, but just an absolute magician with the ball at his feet. And you didn't know whether he was going left or right. He would always go on his right, but then chop back on that left foot. And no, just a magician he was. He was unbelievable. Had some great games against the likes of James Forrest, people like that. But no, definitely Nakamura.
So, Danny, I want to move on to your time at Carlisle United now, where you're a bit of a cult hero at Brunton Park. Firstly, how did it feel to finally join the club that's so close to your heart?
Yeah, a long time coming. Obviously, previous to that, I was ready for sort of calling it a day until Jim Jeffries took me to Dunfermline. Jim pulled me around and got me back in love with the game and coming home and setting up roots and my family being on the doorstep type thing. Yeah, it was a dream come true for me to play for Carlisle. I stood on the terraces as a kid and watched their games and I wanted to play for them. So it was something that obviously I'd wanted to do from day one.
And when you arrived, the club had just been relegated to League Two. Sort of what was the atmosphere around sort of at the time?
It wasn't a great atmosphere, to be honest with you. It was an atmosphere of there was an expectancy of us just to bounce straight back up, and it doesn't always happen like that. And I think, obviously, there was a lot of negativity around the club. It was something that it was hard to be involved with to start with, because obviously, even though I was there as a player, I was there as a fan as well, and I'd seen them get relegated on the previous season. So, obviously, you want to help the one that puts them back up in the division where they want to be, but it wasn't a great atmosphere at the time around the place, and probably wasn't until the following season until we actually sort of felt like we'd turned a corner.
And Keith Curl arrived in the first season. So how much of an impact did he have on the team and you personally as well?
Massive for me personally. Made me captain of the club, gave me a new contract and gave me a lot of responsibility, and it was a big time for me as a player, because I had to step up. I think after about 18 months, Keith had no players left there bar myself that had been there previously, and obviously he knew what it meant to me. I wore my heart on my sleeve, as I always did for any club, but obviously this club meant that little bit more to me. And he upset a lot of people, but he got results and nearly got us to Wembley to that playoff final, but just wasn't quite meant to be.
Yeah, actually, I want to touch upon that game against Exeter, where it was so close. What are your memories over those two legs?
Well, we played them twice in the season and beat them. So we beat them 3-2 at home, scoring two very late goals. And then we played them the last game of the season. And I was lucky enough to score two penalties that day, and we beat them 3-2 again. And then when they went 3-1 up, they were 2-0 up in both of them games. And then they went to us in the first leg and we're 3-1 up and we got it back to 3-3. And then we were 2-0 up in the away leg and we got it back to 2-2. And I can remember I walked back past the lad who was taking the kick-off and he just said, "You can't believe this is happening again. This is insane. I can't believe it's happening again." And I just thought, it was 2 minutes left on the clock, and I just thought, we get these to extra time, they've absolutely gone here. And unfortunately, the boy, Jack, obviously had been alone at us before, and he stuck it in the top corner with his left foot, and I don't think I've ever seen a bit of sweeter ball than that in my life. So just wasn't meant to be, unfortunately. And that, again, that was one of the hardest nights of my football career, to be honest with you.
And after that, did you feel like that was the best chance that Carlisle have had, you know, squandered to go up? Or did you feel like we're going to go again and we'll build?
I think you obviously always look at that. You're going to dust ourselves down and go again. I think obviously the squad that we had was a big, good squad. Players that knew what we had to do, knew what we had to do, our roles and responsibilities. I think we lost a couple that summer and it just didn't quite come back and it didn't click the way it did. We lost Nicky Adams the following season very early, who was influential to a bad knee injury. And unfortunately, we just couldn't seem to get going. I think they ended up finishing 10th that following season.
I want to talk about a moment actually where you wrote yourself into the club history books on the 28th of October 2017, strike against Chesterfield, and it was a rare header from a Nicky Adams corner, and that notched up the club's 5,000th Football League goal. So it must be so nice having that sort of nice little piece of history in Carlisle's history books.
Yeah, obviously, for me personally, to be able to say that with myself, it was great. I think that was the only header I ever scored in my career. So it was a proper, a collected item. So, no, it was... Look, the personal accolades were lovely. Obviously, I think I finished third in the all-time records for the penalty taken. One of the record holders for the most consecutive games scored. Things like that. All them things are really nice for me personally, because I'm associated with the club, I'm associated with the area, and it means something to me. And obviously, to be able to score the 5,000th goal was massive for me as well.
So you've had a few Carlisle fans getting in touch with some questions. So this one's from Carl Byers. What was your favourite game and moment as a Carlisle player?
Favourite game was the last game of the season against Exeter when we won 3-2 and I scored two penalties. Finally got us into the playoffs. And it was massive. And that one, and also I played Newport County at home, one of my last home games. I scored a 93rd minute winner. Them two for me are massive for me. The goal itself against Newport was a decent goal, but as I turned and went to celebrate, I just caught my son's jumping up and down in the stand going mad. And yeah, just personally a special moment for me. And leading out my hometown team at Anfield as an actual moment, that was it. To step out onto that pitch, see 6,000 Carlisle fans behind the goal and lead out your hometown team was something I'll never forget.
We have another question as well from Ross Parkinson. It simply says, what happened with Sheridan after the 6-0 win?
No idea. Listen, payback. I can openly say that I've heard people talk about mine and John's relationship. I've openly said that I don't ever disrespect a manager. I think there's a line and sometimes people can cross it. And again, I've nothing against John. John came in, done what he had to do when he left. Was he one of my favourite managers? No. And did I feel I'd done anything wrong? No. Did I do everything I could for the players as their captain? Yes, I did. And for me, whatever happens in the dressing room always stays in the dressing room. I've heard some crazy rumours about what actually did happen and couldn't have been any further away from the truth because actually nothing did happen. That is the answer to the question. Absolutely nothing happened after the 6-0 win. We won 6-0. I was delighted. Everybody in the dressing room was delighted. But that's as it is.
So you retired from playing a couple of years ago and you've now taken on the Workington Reds job. How did that all come about?
Well, I always said that I was going to finish my career at Carlisle United. I had no interest of going anywhere else. The club that I love, the club that I've grown up with, one that I've always wanted to play with. I don't want to sit in a car for 2 hours on a motorway to go and play for someone in the same division. I got a 3-year contract offer after I'd retired from a club from Manchester wanting me to sign for them in Carlisle's league. And I wasn't interested. I didn't want to go and play anywhere else. And I decided that I had a lot of long, hard conversations with people that I trust, obviously my family, my wife, my dad, people like Neil Dalton, who was my physio at the time, very close to my roommate, Jamie Devitt, Gavin Skelton's, people like this who I was very close with. I had good conversations with them. And I just felt like it was the right time. I just felt like that it was time for me to move on, and I felt that it was time for someone else to sort of come into the dressing room and sort of my mould and do that because I wasn't getting any younger. I always said I've left every club that I can't play at and I can't sit on the bench. I'm passionate, I want to play football. When I wanted to play football, I've got no interest in it anymore. But when it got to that point where I wasn't playing much and I was being on the bench, that was time for me. The hardest thing for me was that I never got one last game for Carlisle after my retirement. That's all I wanted. I wanted one last game, but I couldn't get it because of an injury and wasn't selected for last, I think it was two games. But again, it's a club that I've done more for than most clubs. I would go and do it again and again, and I would do anything for the club. I know I'm the Working Reds manager now, but people know my association to the club, and if they ever sort of ask for help or anything like that regarding anything I could do outside of the football side of it, I would always help. Absolutely love Working Reds. The job came about. I was offered a full-time job coaching elsewhere, back up the road, but it wasn't for me. And I decided that Working Reds was. I went through the interview process. They didn't just give me it. Told them what I wanted to do. I told them what I wanted to build. And the club's been fantastic. And I've got a fantastic relationship with fans. I've got a fantastic relationship with the board and the volunteers and everyone in there, and we're all pulling in the same direction. And some of the comments that you hear about how positive it is around the club and things like that, it makes you feel like you are doing the job right, and that's what I wanted.
So you look at the last two seasons, you've got the team playing very well. It's just been very frustrating, though, that both those seasons have been incomplete. So obviously, as frustrating as it is, he's still looking at it that it's still been a really good process, and he's just looking to build on now for the next season.
Yeah, I started my career at Gretna as a youngster wanting to make it to the top. I'm starting my career as a youngster, 34-year-old manager at Workington Reds, and I want to coach at the top. Now, I want to take Workington Reds somewhere where we all want to be as a club. We've got ambitions, we've got new stadium plans, we've got things in the pipeline that we want to do. We're creating a pathway. We've got an academy, a development centre that brings them through from 8 years old right the way through to 16. We're now creating under 18s. We've got reserves that are filled with nothing but youngsters. And there's a clear pathway, and it's something that from the first team to the reserves to the 18s through the academy, we play the same way. We want to create players. We want to create lads that want to play for Workington Reds first team. Where we are at the moment isn't good enough as a club. The division we're in isn't good enough. We know that, but we've got ambitions to be a lot higher. And like I say, I'm in no rush. People, some of the comments I had from previous managers after leaving, and one of the ones that sticks with me the most is, don't jump at the first option you get. Wait, learn your trade, and the right option will be the one that you take. And it really sat with me that that comment was right, because I know a lot of managers, as soon as they get that first opportunity, they want to jump. Workington Reds fans and Workington Reds club know I want to be a full-time manager at some point. But I'm learning my trade. I'm 34 years old and I want to learn from my mistakes. I'm very, very lucky in the fact that I've got an assistant manager that I bounce everything off, and we've got an amazing relationship inside the football club and outside of it. And we trust each other a lot. And it's great for me as well to have him.
So are you please able to give the listeners actually an insight into how the club has dealt with the pandemic?
We struggled. There's no different from any other club. I think we looked at it last year when we were allowed to have 400 fans at our games. And I think on average, we were probably losing around about £2,000 a game. Now to a football league club, that's no problem at all. But to a non-league club, that is a lot of money. And it was something that couldn't be continued. We have an amazing fan base. The Risk Boys are called. They go above and beyond. They get money in for the club. They do anything, national sweeps. They'll split the money. They'll donate. They've donated thousands upon thousands. I think it was 13,000 they've just donated since the start of the last lockdown. This all helps keep the club afloat, and we have struggled. But we have got a club that have... We don't live without our means. We live to our means. We don't go and pay people more than what they're allowed. I'm strict to my budget. I'm not allowed to go and bring players in over my budget. If I go and ask and the club can find money for me, they'll give me it. But they don't do it if they can't do it. And I don't want them to do it if they can't do it, because I do not want to put Workington Reds in a place where they can't pay wages. But it's been tough. I think the biggest thing for us is that we had 7 games to go in the first season, and we were 10 points clear at the top of the league. We had to lose 5 of our last 7, and we'd lost 4 all season or 3 all season. And we were denied our championship. Last year, we'd started well, and we were 3 or 4 points off top to a game in hand or something like that. But last year was very, very strange. Boys walking into the dressing room, we couldn't do what we'd done, where we'd done our video analysis. We couldn't have team meetings. You couldn't be in a dressing room. Lads would turn up at 7:15 on the pitch at 7:20, off it and home. And you just felt like you never had time with them. You were getting games called off because of COVID. You were getting told there might be a game here, there might not be a game. It was just horrible, horrible. And I'll be honest with you, as much as I didn't want it to finish, I was glad it did finish, because it wasn't real football. I've had my eyes opened since coming down to this level about what it means to fans and what it means to people inside football clubs. And this is real football for me. This means something to them. Lads taking half days. It's not a financial game for them. They've got to take half day holiday on a Tuesday night. But it means something to them to win or lose. And yeah, it's opened my eyes to it, and it's credit to these lads that do play at this level, because I was lucky enough. We'd be away with Carlisle United on a Tuesday night. We'd go down to a hotel at lunchtime, get a little afternoon sleep in a hotel, nice bit of food. They're legging it out of work 20 minutes before meeting the bus to get on that bus, bit of dry pasta, getting off, playing 90 minutes, not getting into bed till 1 o'clock, having to be up at 6 o'clock to be back at work. Not many people can do that, and it's a credit to them. And that's why the first season I was so frustrated for them, because they'd really, really bought into what we wanted to do, and they'd gone about it in the proper way, and they should have had the reward of an absolute fantastic day on our pitch last game of the season. Absolute beaming sunshine it was, and we should have been celebrating, but we were denied it. And look, we've never once turned around and said that this pandemic was nothing, or football was more important, but there should have been a way of doing it when our league was the first league that was declared null and void 10 days after stopping. But like I say, that's what happens sometimes. The bottom end of the pyramid, the bricks at the bottom that hold the pyramid up, aren't really maintained. It's the one that's sat at the top shining bright.
That's a good analogy. Well, you sound very, very committed to Workington Reds. Of course, you're not shy about, you're very ambitious. What kind of manager is Danny Granger, and where do you see your career ultimately going?
I would love to say cool, calm, collected, but I'm passionate. I'm passionate. I'm aggressive. I'll do anything for my players, for my club, for my fans, for my staff. I'll do anything for them. I want them to be successful as much as I want myself to be successful. It's never me, it's never I, there's never a you in team, it's us. We win as a team, we lose as a team, we win as a club, we lose as a club. I'm very, very orientated around us and we. I look at football in a very simple way in my eyes. Every single player that walks on the football pitch will make a mistake. No matter what, they'll make a mistake. Now, if they react and get the ball back, it's fine to make mistakes. If they give the ball away in front of their goal, that's fine, because I'm asking them to play out from the back, as long as they try and stop it, as long as they make honest mistakes. Now, if they're trying to do a Cruyff turn on the edge of the six-yard box, that's a bit different. But I'm passionate. I have expectancy, and I despise, and I genuinely despise and hate acceptance. Whether you work at Reds, whether you're Carlisle United, whether you're Blackburn Rovers, or whether you're Man United or Man City, you've still got to have standards that you've set, and you've still got to stick to them. And I don't accept anything below. And that's not just myself, the staff, the players, that is the club. The board act exactly how we want to act as a club. We represent our club. The fans are expected to behave in the same way. Our fans travel in numbers in non-league like you've never seen. And they make the noise of thousands. And they put a lot of money behind a lot of clubhouse bars. So, but me personally, I am passionate. I am aggressive. And I will demand, but I'm also, I would like to think that the boys know me and they trust me and they know that they come to me. And it's great for me as a manager that I've had players come to me with personal issues, because for me, that means that they've got a trust in me, and that's all I want. And I want these players to be comfortable and enjoy. And when they're running around with a smile on their face, I'm happy.
Well, I think it's safe to say whatever the future holds, it sounds like you're the kind of guy that will make a success of it. Danny, thank you very, very much for coming on Not in the 92, and very best of luck to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for having me, guys. It's been brilliant.
Thank you.